Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
In the far distant future, science tells us that our home planet Earth will become uninhabitable. It seems the human species must one day reckon with living on another planet. But how will we survive the journey? And how can we make a new life on a distant world? One way could be re-engineering our genetic code to withstand the dramatically different environment of another planet. This episode, I spoke to geneticist Christopher Mason to find out how we can prepare for life beyond Earth.
Hello, I am Chris Mason. I'm professor of genetics and physiology and biophysics at Weill Cornell Medicine, which is the medical college for Cornell University in New York City.
Fantastic. Thanks very much for speaking to me today, Chris. Normally on the podcast, we have sort of astronomers or astronauts or space scientists, but you're a geneticist and biologist by trade. Where does genetics and biology fit into the sort of sphere of astronomy and space flight and space?
I think now biology, genetics, really clear molecular measurements of astronauts is becoming a kind of a key and really common feature of going into space and really getting us thinking about not just how do we go visit Mars, but how do we sustainably inhabit the planet and stay there long term. And so really our the experiments that we've been doing and publishing and the work that we've been pioneering or collaborating with others in our lab to really get off the ground is the measurement, the sort of management of astronauts, and even think about ways to protect them in the future with not just physical methods or pharmacological methods, but even genetic methods.
Fantastic. Yeah. So what does space actually do to the human body?
So space is rough on the body. It is, as most people probably heard, hard on the bones, where the bones start to really almost decay away. You can actually see calcium coming out in urine for most astronauts. And it also, the heart essentially shrinks a little bit. Often some of the vasculatures, your veins and arteries, can even get inflamed or even also get a little bit disrupted. It's hard on the brain. You have a lot of radiation coming at you. The fluids move around through your body in different ways. Normally, obviously, human bodies used to having gravity. If suddenly there's no gravity, it's hard on the body. But it's also extraordinarily adaptive. So even though you are irradiated and having all your fluids move in unusual directions, and you're in a confined and isolated space, and it's a tough mission for every time you go up, the body's really plastic. It adapts really quickly. And so we even though we see damaged DNA and broken DNA and dying cells, we see regeneration, we see sort of adaptation, and we see the body quickly respond to spaceflight.
What do you think is a bigger problem for astronauts? Is it the weightlessness, or is it the actual harsh conditions of space, like the vacuum and the radiation?
Yeah, so there are five main hazards of spaceflight that at least have been, that we've published and also are highlighted by NASA, which include, you know, the number one, though, is probably radiation. So I think the biggest risk is, you know, even though you're still within the protective Van Allen belts of the Earth's magnetosphere, you are still getting, when you're up there, about five x-rays a day. And that's normally if you get a chest x-ray, that's just in one spot of your body, right? There's the whole body being irradiated, which, you know, human bodies don't like to be completely irradiated generally, but they can tolerate it, but they'd probably prefer not to. So, you can do it, you know, once a day, twice a day, but five times a day, every day does start to add up. And so we can actually see that radiation and see, you know, basically broken fragments of DNA. It's what's called essentially 8-oxoguanosine, is basically damaged genetic bases come out of the urine, shows us in the blood. We can see the mitochondria responding to this sort of radiation. So that is one of the biggest risks, is radiation. There's also obviously the change in gravity. There is, you know, the isolation of being up there is hard on the brain, on the psychosocial aspects. There's also, you know, some of the other hazards are just, you know, really, you're up there, you're far away. So if something goes wrong, the distance from any ability to get help is a big problem. And then finally, just, you know, it's a harsh environment. So, you know, if something goes wrong, you can't, like, you know, if you're having a bad day on Earth, you can go take a walk outside, and here there's nowhere to go take a walk. So part of the isolation is also there's nowhere to go, even if you want to get away from the isolation.
All this is sort of partly discussed in your new book, which is due to be coming out around the time we're recording the podcast in a few weeks, I think, which is called The Next 500 Years. What does the 500 years of the title refer to?
I put out a plan, actually. I penned this about 10 years ago for our lab's website when I was just starting basically the lab at Cornell. And I thought, well, what's coming in genetics? What's coming in biology? What will be coming as we go the past 5, 10, or 100, or even 500 years? And I put it together because I view it not just as a really an outline or roadmap of technological advancement, but it's really also a very personal treatise of hope for what I think humanity can accomplish in the next 500 years. I will, and not just my lab, but all their collaborating and partner labs, but I will be dead for the vast majority of this plan. The plan is not for me to be around 500 years, but that it is a very human activity to make plans that are long-term. And actually, I think one of the most quintessential human traits is to have a plan that is beyond your own lifetime or even through multiple generations. So I put this together as what I hope will happen and what we're contributing towards directly to better understand the genome, the human genome, as well as other microbial genomes, as well as really other, you know, any biology that we could use to better understand how we can protect ourselves in long-term spaceflight.
I was sort of thinking about that plan. If you want to put it in sort of layperson's terms, is it essentially amount to sort of re-engineering the human body to survive the harsh realities of space? Because most people would sort of think, if we're going to go to Mars, we need to change Mars. But it sounds like you're sort of saying, if we're going to go to Mars, we need to change ourselves.
Oh, I think we may have to do both. I mean, we might have to only do one. Like if suddenly terraforming a whole planet becomes really easy and we can do it over hundreds of years or decades instead of thousands of years or tens of thousands of years, if somehow technologically we get that done, great. But Mars only has 38% of the gravity, so it's going to be hard to keep that atmosphere there. And as we've probably seen in the past, it has kind of already gone away once. So, you know, I'm not against that. That'd be great if somehow we could do that. But I put the book out there as a proposal because we know that we already do modify human cells therapeutically and use them routinely today for immunotherapy, for targeted therapies, for, you know, ameliorating disease. So this is actually not a new thing that we do. It's just now we're doing it, thinking about doing it for either temporary or maybe even possibly permanent genetic changes to enable new features that we already have in our body in some cases, or that we could co-opt from other organisms who've learned how to adapt to really extreme environments. So that's kind of the thesis of the book, is that we can learn from all lessons of evolution in any creature to enable us to survive on places that we currently can't survive potentially.
Yeah, that's so cool because, you know, sometimes whenever you're thinking about the studies into the effects of space and weightlessness on astronauts' bodies, there's a certain element where you sort of think, surely this is all just sort of academic because there's nothing we can actually do about that. You know, there's nothing we can do about space and nothing we can do about the human body. But you're sort of saying that there is something we can do about the human body. We can actually change our genes. Is that actually sort of feasible?
Yeah, 100%. So, and what's extraordinary about this is it seems like it's science fiction. It seems like, oh, how could you do that? You know, this is, what's the basis for that? So what's important about the book is there's not a single description of any of the technology in the book that doesn't already exist today. I'm just basically projecting what could happen as we continue to just slightly improve them. So it doesn't require any strange new technology, strange new device, some new kind of, you know, chromosome that we don't have in our genome or some new, you know, some whole new component of biology. It's just, you know, learning from other creatures, in particular bacteria. We've learned how to use CRISPR, which is their innate, basically, immune system that we can use as a way to edit DNA. We've also learned there's modifications of that where you can do, instead of, you know, genome editing, a lot of people have heard about CRISPR and ways you can modify DNA, almost like a typewriter on your genetic code, but also, or I should say a keyboard. Typewriter makes me sound kind of old, but the, but, you know, you can actually edit, you know, the document of your blueprint of life. But you can also change the epigenomes. There are variations I talk about in the book about what's called epigenome editing, where you're changing not the A, C, G, and T, the genetic code. Instead, you're changing just how it's regulated, whether something is turned on or turned off. Or essentially, you can just turn, you know, just change the light switch of your DNA, not change the electricity of your entire wiring diagram of your body. And what that means is you could turn on genes just as you need them. So if you have a higher burst of radiation, increase DNA repair enzymes just for a little while, and then bring them back down later. There's actually, we have this working in our lab for several projects. And we're also doing, you know, genome editing. We're adding genes from some species and putting them into human cells. So I think, you know, what I describe a lot in the book are technologies that exist today that we're using in my laboratory as we speak that let you change either the genetic catalog of what's in human cells or how you turn them on and off. And both of which I think we could use and deploy to keep future astronauts safe or even current astronauts.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
The Dine Under menu is here for a limited time at Outback Steakhouse. Get an 18-ounce bone-in ribeye and our signature blend of 17 spices, Kingsland pasta, or juicy sirloin and lobster mac starting at just $16.99. That's better than the actual Outback, where even if you caught dinner, you know deep down you couldn't do what needs to be done. Run free, little buddy. Run free. The Dine Under menu. It's better than the actual Outback. Starting at $16.99 for a limited time at Outback Steakhouse. Outback. No rules, just right.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
So cool. I suppose like we're sort of talking about, you know, astronauts on the ISS or sort of astronauts on spacecraft traveling beyond, you know, the moon to Mars and things like that. But just how far could you take it? Like, presumably you couldn't, you know, re-engineer the human body to survive like somewhere like Venus or Neptune, where it's a lot more extreme. You know, Mars is relatively speaking similar to Earth, isn't it? But in comparison to somewhere like Venus or Neptune.
Yeah, there are some planets will be harder than others, no question. So Mars, of course, has only 1% of the atmosphere. It has almost no protective magnetosphere. So you have more radiation, less of a protective atmosphere, less of an atmosphere at all. It's very dry. There is some water ice there. But the other planets, Venus is a hellscape. It's really hot there. You could maybe survive in the clouds, but, you know, I'm not saying we would just deploy biological adaptation mechanisms to survive. We would still need physical protective suits, protective hardware. We'd still want to have potentially pharmacological interventions that we know of, things, drugs that already work or therapeutics that already work and have gone through clinical trials. It's just we're adding another layer. So it's not just physical and pharmacological. It's also genetic protections and adaptations. But I think Venus, that'd probably be pretty high up. I don't know if we can make a human body survive, you know, hundreds of degrees Celsius. And if it's, you know, I talk a lot about Titan in the book because there, it's not necessarily because I think we'd have human bodies that could swim in lakes of methane, which would be really cold. But you could actually potentially, you know, there even, you know, you could actually, methane is a really great source of fuel. So you could have little homes that are maybe using the methane. If there's really lakes of liquid methane, you could actually probably convert some of them into fuel, some of which we already have processes on Earth that work for that. So I think I think we'd still, as humans, want to be in a maybe something near 72 degrees and a place where you can have cocktails and relax. And so, I think we'd still want to have those kind of homes, if you will, that are at least a little close to what we have today.
Yeah, I think though ultimately, when you sort of think about the fact that humans, or well, the idea that humans might one day have to leave Earth, it sort of makes me sad that we would have to leave Earth. You know, like even if we could work out how to survive on Titan or on Mars, it's not really preferable, is it, to just staying on Earth?
Yeah, well, it's actually inevitable. The biggest argument I make, the first thing I say in the book, really, is that it's a sense of duty I feel towards humanity, but also that humans have a unique duty that no other species have. Like, as far as we know, we're the only species that have this really unique awareness of extinction. Humans and humans alone. Again, there might be maybe dolphins think about it, or octopuses, or some pygmy marmosets, but to our knowledge, it's only humans who can understand what it means for a whole species to go away, or for extinction, or even for all of life to go away. And that means it's only us that can prevent it. And our track record on this is mixed as humanity goes, but we at least now are aware of it and can actually serve as basically the shepherds for all of life. And I think life is very precious and very rare in the universe. As far as I know, this is it. And so I'd like it to last longer than just the lifespan of this planet or the solar system. And if you all ethical questions become crystal clear through the lens of a billion year time frame. If you think that long, that's when the sun will start to get too hot. The Earth will probably become pretty uninhabitable by 1 or 1.5 billion years. You know, actually, when I was writing the book, I had this moment of great sadness because I always had in my head the number 5 billion or 4.7 billion years till the sun, becomes a red giant and engulfs the inner planets. I was like, oh, we've got a lot of time. We've got like 5 billion years. But really, they projected a luminescent increase of the sun. It'll be in about a billion years. It's going to get really hot where the Earth will be really hard to survive on. Oceans will start to, start boiling off. It's going to be pretty intolerable. And so I really felt like, I came downstairs and told my wife, I was like, I just thought we had more time. I thought we had 5 billion years, and suddenly realized I'm writing, we really got like a billion years. And, she said, well, that's still pretty far away. I said, I know, but it's the equivalent of having like a son or daughter and thinking, oh, they'll live to be 100 years old, and someone coming and saying, actually, they cannot live beyond 20. It was disheartening to think about that. Everything that's here, if you have perfect world peace and perfect harmony of all organisms on Earth, they'll start to get fried to a crisp within probably in about a billion years and a little bit afterwards. So what that means is if we want anything and everything to be preserved, we have to begin to think about what is the next place we'll go. And there's the usual counter arguments I address in the book as well. We have other things we should spend money on. Should we wait till we have better technology? We can walk and chew gum at the same time. We have already done this for decades, that we can both, use technology to explore space while solving sociological and economic problems on Earth. They can all be addressed at the same time. And it's not a question of if, it's when we have to go, or else it all goes with us.
Yeah, I mean, you've sort of answered this question already, but I was sort of wondering how you would address certain people who might argue of the sort of almost like what they might call the sanctity of evolution. Evolution allowed us to develop, and evolution, or the fate of the universe, if you want to use a word like fate, will eventually get rid of us. So is it almost our moralistic duty to not leave Earth and to leave us to our own sort of evolutionary fate?
So it's a great question. It's a fantastic cocktail party question of, should we let humans perish or not? Like, let's assume that we have the capacity to prevent it, which I argue that we do. Is the universe better off without us or with us is really the key question. And I argue that, again, here, anything that you like in the universe, if it has anything to do with organisms, they will all perish unless something actually protects them and moves them to another planet. So regardless of the issues with humanity, and there are many, there's racism and structural inequalities and injustices that are evident in the news every day. There's nothing else that will protect anything that you might care about on this planet. And so if you're a complete nihilist and you don't care about anything, well, then there's not much to talk about anyway. But if you have any sort of value of any organism or any life form at all, to our knowledge, nothing else can actually safeguard them beyond ourselves. And so for all of our issues, I think that one key tenet and sort of trait of humanity is something that makes us worth preserving and giving us a little bit of credit to keep us around for a little longer. And I do say in the book, it might not be us forever. It could be maybe some other species takes over this idea of like a guardian kind of role in a billion years, or maybe it'd be machines. Some people think AI might do this at some point. AI might like wipe us out, and then maybe they would become the guardians of complex life in the universe. And I'm fine with that. I actually describe it as being matter agnostic towards consciousness, is that as long as there's something that's, I think, caretaking complexity in the universe, I'm okay with it. And it's probably going to be us, but it might be something else too.
Yeah, that sort of brings me on to another point I wanted to ask you is that presumably if we were to do some sort of Earth evacuation and get off the planet, we don't only rely on ourselves to survive. You know, we survive on our ecosystem, but presumably we can't bring all the other animals and plants with us. So we're sort of leaving behind all the things that keep us in that sort of nice balance.
Yeah, we have to either bring some of them with them, and maybe bring the key, bring the favorites with us, or have a very small suitcase you can pick your 10 things you like. Or, you know, we would have to choose carefully. But also described in the book, we could think about ways to reduce our dependency on a lot of the other sort of organisms on Earth that keep us alive. So, for example, there's 9 essential amino acids that everyone needs out of their diet. Out of the 20 amino acids that you need to make all proteins in your body. You know, why is that? Why can't we make all of our own amino acids? It's kind of sad, right? Some organisms on Earth can do that. So I describe methods in the book to make what are called prototrophic humans, where you can make all of your own goods. So then you would just be eating for pleasure rather than necessity. And other things like vitamin C, for example, if you don't have enough vitamin C, say from lines, you might get scurvy. And this is interesting because there is a gene for synthesizing vitamin C that's in our DNA. It's just been inactivated through evolution. It's called AGULO. It's basically called a pseudogene. It's like almost a degraded version of a gene. But if you just tweaked it and reactivated it, we could make all of our own vitamin C. And there's other primates that do this. There's actually a split of kinds of primates. There's some that are dry nose or wet nose. Obviously, humans are a dry nose primate unless you have a cold. But there's others more like wet nose primates, and they still make all their own vitamin C, actually. So there are things we've learned about our genome that we have found and said, well, what if we just put that back to the way it used to be? And that'll make it easier for some of the long trips if we could make our own amino acids and vitamins in our body. But we still want to eat for pleasure whenever you can as well. So we'd have to figure out how to get some desserts in far space. But I don't know what they'll be, brownies or cookies or something. Yeah.
Have you ever thought about what it would take to get to an exoplanet, like a planet that's around a distant star? Like, we know it's basically Earth 2.0. But it's an exoplanet, so we've got to travel, tens or hundreds of light years at least to get there. On the way, we would potentially have to, throughout the journey, die and reproduce and die and reproduce because it's going to take so long to get there. How do you think that would play out in terms of the harsh environment of space and raising families and generations?
It'll require something called the generation shift, which is, it's been described in the literature actually for over 100 years as this idea of people living and dying in the same spacecraft, which to some people, sounds awful because you become a child and you say you're going to be on this one spacecraft. Say it's only 50 or 60 rooms and this is it for your whole existence. And then you're going to have kids and they're going to live and die in the spacecraft. And you, at least in the estimates I have in the book, for some of the possible exoplanets, it might take 20 generations to live and die in that craft before they'd reach an exoplanet. And also when they get there, maybe the exoplanet's not as good as we thought it was from far away. So they might have to go to a different one. So it might actually be 20 or 25 or 30 generations, assuming they have methods for sustainable propulsion and food and resources. So all those things would have to be solved, but they're not unsolvable. They're not like we're trying to create and manipulate antimatter at scale or fold space time, which would be great if we could, but that's, we have no way of doing that now. And so, it also, I think, 20 years ago seemed really impossible because you think, what are you going to do if you're just in like a small ship for decades? But we didn't have a concept, I think, then as we do now, of like you could have the totality of all of Netflix or every movie and every song and every cultural element ever created by humanity could come with you. So you'd have a lot that's with you and more would be broadcast. Even though you're traveling away from Earth, more could be sent from Earth. So you'd get a little bit of updates. So that makes it a little bit more, at least mentally possible. Also, we've all lived in a pandemic for a year and it hasn't been pleasant, but I think people have now things like, well, at least I can get situated for about a year. And the second thing is we have better knowledge of biology that we can keep people alive, I think, in those constrained environments and like the astronauts we've studied. And the final, thing I'd say is we are already on a generation ship. It's just a really big one called Earth. And, there's no other planet you can go to now. You're stuck here. You can maybe go to the space station, right? But it's not like you have any other options. Like, and Earth is wonderful. It's certainly my favorite planet so far, but this is just a really big generation ship that we have here, I'd say.
That's a nice way of putting it. I would definitely like to get your insights on, because you've been involved in the Scott Kelly experiment, which is, anyone who's not aware, is Scott Kelly was the NASA astronaut who spent a year on the space station. Tell us about that study and what you learned.
Yes, so I was the head geneticist for the study, and there were 10 teams chosen, and my lab was one of the 10 teams, so it was really a group effort. but we led a lot of the work on the genetics and the epigenetics and some of the gene expression measures. So what happens to human cells and microbial cells and how they're changing at the DNA and RNA level. And we saw this, you know, worked with Susan Bailey, for example, and we saw that telomeres got longer in space, which was surprising. So we got in some ways almost like closer towards what would be a younger state. And we also saw, you know, a lot of his genes were quickly changing when he got into space, a lot of them dealing with radiation or DNA repair, or actually, you know, immune system adaptation. So we could see all this in his blood, basically. And we're continuing to study him to this day, him and his brother. They're identical twins, and so seeing what happens to them before and after spaceflight, as well as planning for other missions that NASA has set up from other year-long missions, and also with some SpaceX astronauts that are coming. So we're expanding the study to look at other astronauts and see, well, what happens to the body? How do we learn about the changes? And can we help make it less stressful or painful on the body?
Mm. With the Scott Kelly study, was there anything that... how did it sort of happen in terms of what you expected to happen and what you didn't? Was there... Did more stuff happen that you expected to happen, or that you didn't expect?
I guess I'd say, and I kind of alluded to this in the very beginning, is that we saw so many things change. There were more things that changed than I thought would change. Although I guess we, you know, the whole human body in space using the full battery of all of current modern molecular biology methods. And we saw everything change from his DNA to RNA, his microbes change, small molecules in his blood called metabolites. Those change. We saw his lipid levels change, vitamin levels. Like, I mean, essentially, you know, his eyes changed a little bit. His carotid artery in his neck, the big artery in your neck, that got bigger and inflamed. His heart changed. Cognitive metrics changed. Like, everything changed, basically. Almost everything that we were measuring changed. But it's extraordinary. It's almost all of them went back to normal as soon as he got back to Earth, given a few days. And so we saw, like, even those microbes in his gut and his stomach changed. He got different composition and went back to normal. And a lot of his genes changed expression, going up and going down and really adapting. About 93% of them went back to normal. Some of them still were perturbed 6 months later, but mostly went back to normal. And also telomeres got back to normal when he got back to Earth. He was even 2 inches taller when he was in space, but that went right back to normal as soon as he landed. So what's extraordinary is that really everything changes when you're in space, but the almost all of it, the body can put back together once you're back in gravity.
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously, you know, Scott Kelly's still, you know, touring the world and writing books, and he's still a, you know, a smart, physically fit guy. But were there any of those differences that you thought, oh, actually... If that kept going for 5 years, that would actually be a problem?
Yeah, some of this is around the mutations we could see in his bone, you know, in his blood, basically coming from his bones, where we saw one measure is called clonal hematopoiesis, which means it's mutations, like a clone of a mutated cell that you can find in the bone marrow, that what makes your blood, the hematopoiesis. And we could see different mutations going up and down, and then some of them coming up after he got back on Earth. And I mean, we don't have enough data yet to know if it's really because of the radiation or the stress of the space flight, but there are certain aspects of, you know, basically every mutation we found in him, we're keeping an eye on long term. It's almost like a surveillance to make sure nothing gets out of too big. Or, for example, if you have a mole on your back and it's not so much a problem if you have a mole. It's when it starts to get too big or starts to change color, or, you know, it's like any potentially, you know, a worrisome spot on your body or in your DNA. You just keep an eye on it. As long as it stays the same, it's probably okay. But if it starts to get bigger or change, that's when we want to, you know, think about therapies or other options.
Mm. And with the results from something like the twin study, the Scott Kelly study, does that sort of give you the ability to look at the data and sort of say, right, these are from a genetics point of view, these are the things we need to concentrate on being able to fix or being able to change?
Yeah, basically gives us a roadmap of which genes, which molecules are the most responsive to spaceflight, are the ones that we could target, are the ones that we could actually, you know, help, almost giving like a boost if you need more of something, or tamper down if you need less of other molecules. So we basically have, you know, a molecular roadmap of spaceflight that we could start to look at, you know, other missions, someday other planets and things. So if gravity's, ideally if gravity's lower, we think that some of these molecules wouldn't be as harsh on the return to gravity. So for example, space wasn't so bad as much as it was returning back to gravity was really rough on the body, much more so than even getting into space for a lot of these markers. So we think, that's where we're focusing a lot of our efforts now. Is leaving gravity is rough, but getting back is even harder, I'd say.
just to go back to a point you made earlier, about sort of people saying, shouldn't we be concentrating our efforts on Earth? Presumably, a lot of the stuff out of the twin study or the Scott Kelly study or all the sort of space genetics that you're doing, presumably that does have uses on Earth.
Yeah, several things did. So we, you know, some of this, just the protocols for doing experiments in space, means they had to be by definition in a small and limited resource setting. So we actually pioneered DNA sequencing in space and collection methods for getting cells preserved in space with Scott Kelly, and with a follow-up mission with Kate Rubens, particularly on the sequencing. So it really forced us to develop new tools and methods that could work in zero gravity, pipettes that work in zero gravity, and also technologies and tools that work fine in zero gravity. But you can only have really one or two or three steps. You can't have a 25-step protocol doing it in zero gravity. It's too hard to do. But you can actually, you know, force us to get protocols so we can do diagnostics in space. So we can actually start to do blood draws in zero gravity and characterize that blood. And then also to analyze the data. So we actually did sequencing and analysis of data, in space. So you can do it on, basically you can put almost a supercomputer, the components of it into as much of it, cram it into an iPad basically, or a Surface Pro, and do the analysis of sequence data right there in the space station. So it forces to be nimble from programming to experiments to the informatics of the data.
It's absolutely fascinating. Chris, thanks very much for speaking to me today about this. It's good luck with all your future research. I can't wait to hear what else comes out of the Scott Kelly study, and obviously good luck with the book when it comes out. And yeah, thanks again for speaking to me.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky Night Magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Brittany Colley. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skynightmagazine.com or head to iTunes, Acast, Spotify, or your favourite podcast provider.